is. Dialogue Conspiracy is a program which shares the political research of Mae Bressel. Her almost 10 years of work are based on the theory that government is moved as much or more by conspiracy than by any democratic process. Welcome to another Saturday of Dialogue Conspiracy. I don't know if I'm going to get used to this setup, May, because we have here in the studio, come on, equipment, there you go. We have in the studio now a true stereo for the show due to the overwhelming demands of people. And so we have May on the, well, I don't know if you have her on the right channel or not. May, say something. May is on the right channel. I have the left channel. That has no political significance whatsoever, I assure you. But some people may have their stereo reversed, in which case some homes will have you on the left and I'll be on the right. But I'm sure don't attach any meaning to that.
Okay, when the show goes, we'll scramble the...
Those of you with monaural radios are getting the really objective portion of the show. Dialogue, what is Dialogue Conspiracy? I should ask you that because I know you're going to ask me to explain it, and I'm going to refuse.
Yeah, you explain it. You did it so well.
Dialogue Conspiracy is a fictional program. No, it's purely non-fiction program dealing with politics and the news of the day. May started her research following the John Kennedy assassination almost a decade ago, and has become involved in Martin Luther King assassination as far as the study of that, and the Bobby Kennedy assassination, and has been following the events which she feels are tied into the causes behind those assassinations and the what appear to be lies and contradictions that are in the news and are in the events surrounding the assassinations. And for that reason, the show is called Dialogue Conspiracy, because it seems to be a pattern of conspiracies and cover-ups and other things involved in these events and everyday events. So today's show will be another look at what's in the news and how the news of today ties into the past and how it may influence the future.
I guess the news of this week, we should discuss a little bit the Republican convention in terms of conspiracy, and my favorite subject in terms of conspiracy, Nixon and Agnew. Because I feel that Richard Nixon is a selected person, a front man who's packaged to the American people by a handful of individuals, and that he's been the front man since 1945 when he was selected to run in Congress against Voorhees. He's been the front man for some very wealthy munitions people, aerospace industries, bankers, and oil industry, and he represents the wishes of those people.
Well, how do you find a politician that isn't representing somebody in these days where it takes so much to get elected?
Well, I think that
takes a lot of money to get elected.
If you study American history, the way the Constitution was made up of the electoral process is in the past, maybe the Republican Party, say, represented the very wealthy and the interests of the very wealthy, and the man who was to get the nomination or the election from that group of people, maybe they're what you refer to as the vested interest, went around the country and went to different places like Illinois, Ohio, California, and Florida. He went campaigning and met the industrial leaders of those places or the newspaper publishers and participated in knowing the individuals who run the country, and they in turn elected him to represent them. But Nixon came to power through several circumstances, and in his book, My Sixth Crisis, the first crisis he talks about was the confrontation that Alger Hiss and Whitaker Chambers had, which catapulted Nixon into fame. And that particular incident, I've tried to write about in an article called How Richard Nixon Came to Power. That was the use of planted evidence, which you get in conspiracies that I study, Very often, in this case, it was the Woodstock typewriter and the microfilm that catapulted Nixon to power. And the second crisis that Nixon had after the Alger, Hiss, Whitaker, Chambers was called the slush fund. And he was accused of having more money than any other politician and getting it from somewhere. And the chapter in my sixth crisis is very interesting on the sources of money. Where did Nixon get the money? And he made his famous Checkers speech. My wife has a cloth coat, and I just received a dog named Checkers from a man from Texas. He doesn't say the man is Howard Hughes or that Howard Hughes is giving his brother money or where he's getting his money. The point was that while no other man who was running for Congress had the kind of money he had, or vice president, a secret society, a group of men whose names aren't published, a committee of 100 in California, put up the money to start Nixon's campaign fund, and they ran an ad in the paper, wanted a man to represent their particular interests. Well, this state grew into a warfare state and a munitions development state, aerospace, and the way he came to power is when he answered this ad. It was simply an advertisement. I have a copy here. It was in August 45 when 100 men in California put an ad. Wanted congressman candidate with no previous political experience to defeat a man who has represented the district for 10 years. Any young man, resident of the district, preferably a veteran, fair education, no political strings. They said no political. But this Richard Nixon, he didn't apply for the ad. The ad was run out in California. It said applicants will be interviewed by 100 interested citizens, and they're not obligated to the candidate in any way. Well, while that ad was in the paper in California and everyone who applied was turned down, Nixon receives a telephone call back east when he's still in the service. Do you want this job?
Now, the man, from who?
From Mr. Perry, vice president then of the Bank of America. And at that point, then Bank of America just went on to be the largest bank in the world, the largest private bank in the world. And he called Nixon, who was an unknown man. And this committee of 100 brought Nixon to the West Coast and groomed him to run against Voorhees in California.
Is he still associated with this committee?
Well, he's associated with this group, and they changed their faces. And in 1963, after the Kennedy assassination, became known as another group called the Lincoln Club. And one of the things that I've worked very hard to try to get people to expose is the list of men behind these organizations, because they fund, they give extra money. Say, if Nixon says, I am a Republican, and I'm just like every other Republican running for Congress or for vice president, you know, along with Eisenhower at the time, that's what he's saying. It's a fair competition. But at those days, they were spending thousands of dollars, what was $100,000, then maybe $1 million or $10 million today, you know, keeping his name, not television, but trips and speaking engagements and press accounts, press releases, keeping his name in the news, sending him around, transportation, mailing, things in the mail. Everyone got letters from Richard Nixon. Well, it cost money for other congressmen for private purposes. This slush fund was keeping him where nobody else was in the news. Not that he was more worthy or more intelligent or doing anything
more. Well, those things are done today, though, still.
Well, he was selected as the man who would be always in the forefront, not on the basis of any particular knowledge or ability, except that he represented the interests of the war machine.
So he was a front?
Well, I think he was.
Group,
he was
a front.
Yes, I think I would say he was a front for this group.
Okay, well, bring it to today.
Well, today, when we get to a situation like the conventions this week, Spiro Agnew is nominated. The newspaper, the San Jose Mercury, an article says Spiro Agnew, the unknown.
How do you say Spiro?
Spiro. You call him Spiro or Ted? What do you call
him? Spiro.
Spiro, the unknown.
Spiro T, sometimes when I'm really getting frustrated.
Well, I call him something else when I'm not on the radio.
But everybody, he's supposed to be a household word by now.
Spiro?
And you're saying Spiro.
Well, out of spite.
Out of spite. Just to make sure that he's not a household word in your house.
No, they describe him as the unknown whose name became synonymous with partisan division, except for the nomination. The Mercury described him that way. Today, Margaret Chase Smith said he was a breath of fresh air and political smog and double talk that goes on, and that 4 years ago nobody knew who he was, but now he's a household word. And I think that Spiro, if you call him that, was put upon the American people, foisted there guaranteed this time the nomination in 76. He represents a handful of people. And with this country, so many people well-known like Rockefeller and so much wealth in the hands of the Rockefellers, and they've been political all their life, Romney, Percy, and all the other Republicans that were working actively around this country, the Republican Party, are all put aside and everything is cleared for this man, either if Nixon's killed or if he isn't killed, to follow, to be the successor to this thing. And I think that he is manipulated through a tremendous amount of money and pressure.
And
by the people that want him into power. I think
Richard Nixon?
Well, I think that there's a lot of hardcore conservatives that aren't very happy with Richard Nixon, and they have their friends
saying, the John Birch Society, they despise Richard Nixon.
There's a hard, long group of people that despise him, and his enemies are saying, I just love you, and I've been afraid of a plot against Nixon for a long time. They've been very sweet to him. They didn't even put up a contest like they used to, like Reagan or Rockefeller for the presidency. They just, or put up any fuss like for next year. It seems that the deal is made.
Let me ask you, you speak of a deal as far as Agnew goes, that he was made the vice presidential nominee this year again, mm-hmm. because the way has been cleared for him to be the presidential nominee in 76, when, of course, Richard Nixon can't run again.
Yeah.
What does Spiro Agnew have on the administration that puts him in a position to make a deal? It's surely probably one of the easiest things in the world to dump a vice presidential candidate.
Well, one of the things he's got that I feel is important is that you can't run an election without money. And I think he has unlimited wealth at certain people, oil people, munitions people, the warfare industries.
Doesn't Richard Nixon still have that? You say he once did, he does now.
Well, Richard Nixon once had their support on the condition that he took Agnew as vice president. He didn't have the nomination in the bag
last year. What about the Committee of 100 of the Lincoln Club? Don't they wield the power they used to?
Well, maybe they have wielded it behind Agnew, that they tell Nixon, if you want our support, then you have to take Agnew. See, the condition is you take Agnew. So as long as we don't know the names of those 100, we don't know where they fit into this scene. There shouldn't be such a secret group. They should be published so we know who decides the president. Obviously, the people on the floor don't decide it.
Okay, you say that Spiro T, has this enormous amount of potential financial power behind him, and that has probably enabled him to assure himself a spot on the presidential ticket in 76. We've also on past shows talked about the $10 million contributed to the Nixon campaign, which was before the April 7th date, after which campaign funds contributions had to be disclosed. And we've wondered on the show where that $10 million came from. Do you think that the $10 million came from Agnew backers?
You see, I definitely do, and we'll go back into the Watergate, for a great part of our show. But all of the people that are involved in the Watergate that have been apprehended or going to be questioned or refused to answer questions so far are all on the Agnew side. They're all the Agnew team. G. Gordon Liddy, we'll go into him, the attorney, for this group, and Howard Hunt. And all of the group that are being apprehended are strong Agnew people, the co-founder of Young Americans for Freedom, Charles Colson of the White House.
Before we get into that, and we're starting to get into detail, and we've mentioned the Watergate.
No, the $10 million funding thing are all Agnew people. Yes.
Let's move into the Watergate affair, as you've called it, and explain what the Watergate is.
Before we do that, let's just wind up the Republican convention with an article that pretty well describes it. There were several in the paper this week describing the staging. I guess you saw all those articles that came in.
Oh, sure, we had some on us, probably. Yeah. It was called the programmed convention as opposed to the Democratic Open Convention.
Well, one of them was an article, Who's the Real Richard Nixon? The people feel he's a robot. And there was one about, they compared it to flushing down a toilet. That was a funny comparison. Joseph Alsop was, this year the voters are going to choose their presidents the way they choose plumbing fixtures. Did you see that one?
No.
The main test of a plumbing fixture was whether it flushes. That was funny because the Watergate affair, they said that the men all arrested were part of a White House operation that were called the plumbers. That was the codename of Hunt and Liddy and Colson and the group at the Watergate were called the Plumbers. But Alsop said, a plumbing fixture president is something new in American politics. If you run over it in your mind, all the presidents of the 20th century, you can't think of one who got a majority without a drive of wide personal enthusiasm in the electorate. The century's major presidents, and also its very worst, Warren G. Harding, have been loved presidents. And then he goes in, not so with Richard Nixon. He's not loved, and they have to push his image. But the one who pushes, they refer to this as the plumbing thing, you know, and the Watergate men refer to as the plumbers. There's been many articles. The stage was set by the man who designed the dating game. And I say
Wolper Productions.
Yeah, the productions.
Jack Anderson pointed out that they hired Wolper Productions to present a filmed image of President Nixon because he comes across so poorly live.
Yeah.
So they did a production film.
Oh, a sideline.
A couple of them.
Did you see John Wayne's article in the paper this week? He said the story about the dikes breaking in Vietnam wasn't very bad because they don't build them very well. They were poorly built.
They asked him where his information was, and he said a small California newspaper printed it a while ago.
That they were poorly built.
Yeah.
Nothing fell on. But there was one, William Broom from the San Jose Mercury, covered the convention fairly well, but he made some pretty good observations in the stagecraft. He talked about the stagecraft of the planning of the convention, and John Ehrlichman saying they didn't want any hostile witnesses. People like McCloskey and everybody were sidetracked. And
it doesn't speak very well for the Democratic system, does it?
Well, here's a remark which is dangerous by Ronald Reagan. John Mitchell had the quotation last year, watch what we do, not what we say. And the article said the conservative-dominated Rules Committee junked virtually every proposal that would give representation to blacks, youth, minorities. A quota is a quota is a quota, they said at their meetings. Now, here's a quotation from Ronald Reagan. He said, we have seen our opponents urge us on pure democracy, the elimination of the features that made us a republic. He says, we don't need a pure democracy, we're a republic. That was Ronald Reagan. And that they, you know, their convention was tied up, and they had total control. The entire convention was controlled. The article by Broom said it was preordained, tightly controlled, operated by script. Even the ministers who gave invocations had to submit their prayers for approval.
Miami. To God or to the Republican Party?
Oh, let me think about that. Is that the convention was operated like a gigantic trade fair to show off what the first Nixon term had wrought. And the president may have turned the entire convention into a television studio. Well, this is what I mean by his...
think pretty everybody assumes that he did.
Yeah. But here's the conclusion which Broom made, which I think is going to come true. Without exception, the delegates that came here, believe their party is going to win a landslide. But it is doubtful that they have yet grasped that the grand old party may never be the same 4 years later. You see, they not only couldn't speak up, and they couldn't go to the committees, and they couldn't show dissension, and they couldn't mention one other man, like there's one vote for McCloskey out of the whole floor. No, two men abstained from Agnew and gave their reasons, but it hardly represents... You say, what's the difference between the old-time political system, you know, and wasn't it always like this? Well, maybe you're too young to remember, but there was some fighting and controversy or preference or compromise on the rules and the quotas and things. It's straight, what you'd call a right-wing closed system. It doesn't even have to be a convention anymore. I don't know why they went through it, all the vote counting and everything. There really wasn't any reason.
Makes you wonder.
Yeah.
Well, let's... We could go on and on about the convention. And
well, it fits in with the conspiracy thing because I feel that the government was overthrown and that this is no convention or was not going to be a convention or an election.
It didn't seem too necessary for the delegates to be there, that's for sure.
For sure.
It had all been decided beforehand and people could have mailed their choices in and it would have turned out the same, I'm sure.
But what's worse is they made the decision for 76, too. You see, it's all Reagan will be the vice president, Agnew will be the president. That is all decided, you know, in the event either that Nixon's killed. And I think it was very important for them to open this convention by speaking about 76. So then in case anything happens to Nixon, they can say, well, inasmuch as he's been accepted for 76, there's no problem now. In case people object, say, to Agnew taking over right away or feel
it's already been said.
It's been said.
What about the Watergate? A lot has been said about that. I think that there are moves afoot, not only by the Democrats, but by members of the media, to try and push the Watergate affair into the prominence that many people believe it deserves. The Watergate Hotel is the national headquarters for the Democratic National Committee. It also was the residence of John Mitchell, who is the chairman of the president's reelection campaign, and it was also the headquarters for the Republican National Committee. And back on June 17th. I've told maybe before we went on the air, I'm bad with dates. On June 17th. Five men were caught inside the headquarters of the Democratic National Committee with sophisticated eavesdropping devices and with large sums of money on them. And they have been traced back to the Republican machinery and the White House. And their money has been traced back to the campaign funds for the reelection of the president. There have been investigations underway by the FBI, for what it's worth. Well, you've said that, and I'm trying to summarize.
Yeah.
Contending that the FBI may be involved in it, that makes it, you know, as you've said, you suspect the government of being involved, and because the person who is, you have claimed that the White House is involved, and yet the White House has ordered the investigation, and the executive branch has ordered a group that is tied in with the executive branch to conduct the investigation. It's a little suspicious, as you've said in the past. I'm just trying to summarize what you've said somewhat. So despite all this and the fact that it's an election year and this is involved in presidential politics and the reelection of the president and the challenger, it hasn't received a great deal of publicity aside from the initial splash in the papers and it's on the TV and radio.
Well, the articles that I have, like, I have two full notebooks of articles. You don't realize how much is dripping in.
But it's not the Pentagon papers by any means.
No, it hasn't gotten the publicity for several reasons. First of all, when it broke, nobody knew what to make of it because some very important people were involved. And 4 days after the Watergate incident, John Mitchell resigned from the committee to reelect the president. So that should be an inkling that something very big was going to follow. And I don't think the media was ready to handle what was taking place. The article that I did for The Realist was the first explanation to be printed in the United States on a motive other than just bugging. And the motive that I suggested in the article was that this is the team, the hidden government, the one that would take over in the event that McGovern is killed and would be behind either the killing of McGovern or would be behind martial law and killing of Richard Nixon, making Agnew president of the United States. That there are two governments, one visible and one invisible, that Kennedy referred to, and that this is that second team. Well, this is a pretty startling thing to put in a 20-page article, and the men in L.A., we had a press conference, and they were really freaked out, the establishment press, you know. The Washington Post was very anxious for the material. The Washington Star was. Life and Time, and all the major news media have a copy of my article now. But they're moving cautiously, and they're investigating every little question, because the article asks more questions than it answers. It throws out a lot of questions. And I got a call from the news department, the Chronicle in San Francisco, and he said, believe me, the news departments are taking it seriously. And they're investigating all the kinds of things that you've suggested to say that there is this hidden team. They've not been able to face conspiracies until now. And as they investigate and get more leads into this thing, it's going to keep making the news and make more news. In the last week, it wasn't in the papers up here, but the L.A. Times said that a Mr. Gerstein, a district attorney in Miami, has placed a suit. I don't know if you're aware of it, Phil. He's told the Justice Department that he's aware of a conspiracy that took place because the bank that Bernard Barker, one of the men arrested in Washington, used, the controversial bank is in Florida, Miami. And that's the geographical area where Gerstein's a DA. And his suit involves a conspiracy that involves the Watergate, naming prominent Americans that everybody will recognize when he mentions their names. So he's given it to the Justice Department. Now, they haven't publicly said those names, But he has promised that if the Justice Department holds them back, he will do a suit similar to what Jim Garrison did, only people are onto it now. You know, they passed off Jim's efforts in 67, but people are onto these things now more. And he says if they slide back that he doesn't care about politics, that he will place this suit because he's more interested in justice. So, and then Senator Proxmire, while the Republican convention was going on, he was on the floor of Congress recommending that Congress, the Senate, investigate the Watergate Hotel incident. And he's interested in this second government, this hidden government. And it didn't get the news because Nixon got the news all these days. But in the next few weeks, as they delve deeper into the news, it's going to break. Time magazine had an article this week, which I brought in, on the Watergate issue. Now, they used to call it a caper. I'm writing a book calling it the Watergate Affair, so that you'll think of it like the perfume affair that rocked England. It will be the Watergate Affair if this is the hidden government, the secret government. And Time made some interesting discoveries, which have to do, for those of you that listened to my radio shows before, this is going to sound familiar. They said that the Watergate forces were planning to plant incendiary bombs in the hall during the Democratic convention or conspire to have the hall stormed by paid Cuban mercenaries. Now, you know, when we talked about Squad 19 and Lewis Tackwood saying that at the conventions, that he was talking about particularly the Republican conventions, that there would be paid provocateurs that would kill people inside the buildings and outside, and the exile, he didn't say the exile Cubans, he said the provocateurs would create a situation that would require martial law. People disbelieved, even at the press conference in L.A., people disbelieved that killings are planned, the violence is planned, that you sacrifice bodies on the street in order to get law and order, like Hitler did. We saw what Hitler did, and it worked, and people don't want to admit that. But yet I understand that the car across the street from the Watergate that one of the men used, the Chrysler, was filled with arsenal and weapons and this type of thing. But now Time has to, they're doing research on this, and they have to have some background to say these men were planting incendiary bombs and planting violence. See, so that's just one little bit. You can imagine how much more there are. So now this establishment newspaper is saying it. This isn't coming some radical underground that people say, well, where did you get that source of information? The researchers on Time and all, as they investigate my story on the Watergate, I think you're going to see more and more of similarities to what I'm saying coming out. Because he said, the incident has given the Democrats ammunition they couldn't have imagined, the whole Watergate story. Time has a large article. It says, as the cops moved in, the Justice Department officials learned of recording equipment in the Howard Johnson Motel across the street. Now, I got a call just this week from somebody back east in New York who went to the Watergate Hotel, and he does computer work and electronic work, and they were glad to show him the headquarters that were bugged in the ceiling. And he also was able to inspect or see the Howard Johnson Motel, and because of the wiring setups of that, he figured it was very difficult, because you don't use direct wiring, to pick up what was being said at the Watergate. But from the offices that were bugged by that window directly to John Mitchell's apartment, there was an open space where messages could be carried directly. And I wrote, again, in the story in The Realist on Martha Mitchell, why she's a prisoner. She said she saw dirty things, and she lives at the Watergate Hotel. So the message I got, you know, from this person who does computer and electronic work was, your speculation about did Martha see any of the men who were bugging or did the messages go to their place could possibly turn out to be, people are working on all these leads and checking mm-hmm. them out, see? And I think you'll see more in the news. Here was another important thing that was in Time magazine. Well, this is where they referred to the plumbers. It said this intelligence crew that was involved in the Watergate team, the so-called plumbers, was originally recruited by the administration to investigate leaks to the media. Now, Richard Nixon was being embarrassed because things said at the National Security Council about India and Pakistan were linked to the news. Now, no one in the Democratic headquarters got those links. Jack Anderson got them, but this is the cover for the group being formed, you see. This isn't why they were really formed. I still think it's that hidden government. They said it was to check news leaks to the media. They included G. Gordon Liddy, the former White House staffer, Robert Mardian, the former assistant U.S. attorney. Mardian was the one involved in the ITT who was pressing for a tougher decision, you know, and then he backed out and resigned and was appointed a judge somewhere. Mardian was in on this, and Howard Hunt of the Watergate. And they go into a man, time goes into the name of a man, Manuel de Guerra, Manuel Oguerra de Guerra of Mexico, who had the $89,000 that ended up in Miami at the account of Bernard Barker. And this money had gone from the Republican committee, now it's been discovered, the $89,000, to Mexico, to Manuel de Guerra, to Miami. And if these men were just doing surveillance and not double espionage, the kind where you overthrow the country or save money for assassinations, like whether it's for shooting Wallace that time or shooting McGovern if you have to, or Nixon if you have to, you can't send a direct check. It has to lose its course as many times over. This has to
so
be...
this went through Mexico.
This went from the committee to Mexico. Well, the man who has that account at Mexico... one of his clients is Gulf Resources and Chemical Corporation of Houston, Texas. And Robert Allen, the president of that corporation, is the chairman of the Texas Committee to Reelect Richard Nixon. Now, what all this means is very complicated for people who haven't followed the entire case. But in summary, I've contended that James McCord, one of the men arrested at the time of the Watergate Hotel, who was a paid employee of the committee to reelect Richard Nixon, has strong contacts in Houston. The agency that was hired to have protection for the convention in